Well, I'd like to then introduce Nick Everett. Nick Everett is a member of Socialist Alternative in Perth. He was also a former member of the Democratic Socialist Party, and he has been a socialist for a very long time, since 1988. That's 2.5 decades. That's the year, just the year after I was born, actually. So he definitely knows what he's talking about. So we're really lucky to be able to hear from him on the role of heroes and crowds, the role of the individual in history. So he's going to be speaking for about 25, 30 minutes, and after that there's going to be plenty of time for discussion and a debate. So I really encourage people to take notes. If there's anything you want to say, there's questions you've got, write it down so that we can have a discussion once Nick is finished. So yeah, make him feel welcome.
Okay, thank you for that introduction. And in beginning, as it was mentioned, this is the first of the philosophy streams, so I'm hoping this talk will provide a useful introduction to some key ideas of Marxism, and I'd certainly welcome any questions at all that it raises in the discussion. So the role of the individual in history has throughout the centuries been the subject of heated debate. In his book on heroes, hero worship, and the heroic in history, Robert Carlyle, a 19th century Scottish historian, argued, "The history of the world is but the biography of great men." And many bourgeois historians to this day argue history is made by great men and women, kings and queens, statesmen and politicians. Supposedly through force of their own character, they have changed history whilst the masses have played little or no role. Well, the great man theory hasn't been confined only to defenders of the capitalist order. The anarchist Emma Goldman once wrote, "Always, at every period, the few were the banner bearers of a great idea, of liberating effort. Not so the masses, the leaden weight of which does not let it move." Well, in contrast to this subjectivist view of history, there are those who argue that individuals determine nothing, but are simply tossed around by the waves of history. This fatalist view views individuals acting as mere marionettes, their strings pulled by some invisible hand. We are all reduced to the role of pawns. Well, this idea gained prominence in Europe in the 16th century as a reform movement broke with the Lutheran Church. Followers of John Calvin, known as the Calvinists, argued that all human action is divinely predestined. Calvinism stressed the absolute sovereignty of God's will, arguing that God specifically elects those that are saved. A man is known to be one of God's elect, according to the Calvinists, if he is successful in his professional activity, or read bourgeois entrepreneurial activity. Thus, the primitive accumulation of capital and the acquisition of profit were given religious justification. Consequently, Calvinism played a major role in two early bourgeois revolutions, in the Netherlands in the 16th century and especially in the English Revolution of the 17th century. Well, the Reformation, as it became known, gave rise to the materialist philosophy of the 18th century, which met the philosophical requirements of the rising bourgeoisie, its need to develop natural science for the advancement of industry, and the struggle against the feudal aristocracy and its allies in the Catholic Church. However, the materialism remained mechanical, reflecting the mechanical state of the natural sciences at the time. The bourgeoisie viewed the masses as passive instruments of production, incapable of historical initiative and independent action. Karl Marx rejected the crude mechanical materialism that dominated German philosophy in the early 19th century. One of his earliest philosophical works, The Thesis on Feuerbach in 1845, begins with this criticism. He says, "The chief defect of all hitherto existing materialism, that of Feuerbach included, is that the thing, reality, sensuousness, is conceived only in the form of the object or contemplation, but not as sensuous human activity practice, not subjectively. Hence, in the contradistinction to materialism, the active side was developed as abstractly by idealism, which of course does not know real sensuous activity as such." The idealism to which Marx refers here is particularly that of Hegel, whose challenge to the materialists of the time recognised the role of ideas in shaping consciousness. Hegel resurrected the term dialectic, made popular by Plato in ancient Greece, but gave it new meaning to express how quantitative changes with the build-up of a contradiction flow over into qualitative change. And I've given you there a very succinct definition of dialectics, which hopefully can be explored further in subsequent philosophy sessions at the conference. Marx and Engels argued that Hegel rendered philosophy too abstractly ideal. The mystification which dialectic suffers in Hegel's hands by no means prevents him from being the first to present his general form of working in a comprehensive and conscious manner, said Marx and Engels. With him, it is standing on its head. It must be turned right side up again if you would discover the rational kernel within the mystical shell. In contrast to Feuerbach's mechanical materialism and Hegel's idealism, Marx and Engels set about developing a dialectical materialist approach, stressing the active role of human beings in making their own history. In The Holy Family, Marx and Engels observed, "History does nothing. It possesses no immense wealth. It wages no battles. It is man, real, living man, who does all that, who possesses and fights. History is not, as it were, a person apart, using man as a means to achieve its own aims. History is nothing but the activity of man pursuing his aims." Or we could say today, men or women pursuing their aims. Whilst people make their own history, we do so not in circumstances of our own choosing, as Marx famously observed in the 18th Brumaire of Louis Bonaparte. He said, "Men and women make their own history, but they do not make it as they please. They do not make it under self-selected circumstances, but under circumstances existing already, given and transmitted from the past. The tradition of all dead generations weighs like a nightmare on the brains of the living," wrote Marx. "And just as they seem to be occupied with revolutionising themselves and things, creating something that did not exist before, precisely in such epochs of revolutionary crisis, they anxiously conjure up the spirits of the past to their service, borrowing from their names, battle slogans, and costumes in order to present this new scene in world history in time-honoured disguise as borrowed language." Marx observed that Camille Desmoulins, Danton, Robespierre, St. Just, Napoleon, the heroes as well as the parties and the masses of the old French Revolution performed the task of their time, that of unchaining and establishing modern bourgeois society. "Unheroic though bourgeois society is," explained Marx, "it nevertheless needed heroism, sacrifice, terror, civil war, and national wars to bring it into being." Marx never dismissed the role of the individual in history, but for the first time placed this role in the fullness of its historical context. Marxism explained that no person, no matter how talented, capable, or far-sighted, can determine the main course of historical development, which is shaped by objective forces. However, under critical circumstances, the role played by individuals can be decisive, the last decisive link in the chain of causality. The role of Lenin in the Russian Revolution is one such example, which I'll return to and which we can discuss further in after the talk. However, under critical circumstances, critics of the Marxist view of history have accused Marxism of being economic determinist, denying any role for the individual in shaping history. One of the first to do so was Edward Bernstein, the German socialist who developed the first reformist revision of Marxism. Bernstein described materialists as Calvinists without God. The criticism of Marxism as overly determinist can in part be explained by the accommodation of a more mechanical materialism by the reformist parliamentary and trade union leaders of German social democracy, who came to argue that objective historical forces would deliver power into the hands without a mass revolutionary struggle by the German proletariat. Karl Kautsky, the most prominent German Marxist theoretician at the time, wrote, We know that our objectives can be attained only through a revolution, but at the same time, we know that it is just as little in our power to make the revolution as it is in the power of our opponents to prevent it. The proletariat's victory and the defeat of capitalism are inevitable, he argued. But this tendency to mechanical materialism, exemplified by the reformist leaders of German social democracy and later by the Russian Mensheviks, cannot be used as an argument against Marxism. In the final analysis, it only reflects the pressure of bourgeois ideology and material conditions on the Marxist movement. In the same period, Rosa Luxemburg in Germany and Lenin and his Russian supporters articulated a Marxism that was anything but fatalistic, emphasising the active role of the working class in self-emancipation. In 1898, the Russian Marxist Plekhanov penned the essay On the Role of the Individual in History as a polemic against the Russian Narodniks, who portrayed the individual hero, usually armed with a bomb, as the creator of history. The Russian masses were relegated to the role of mere onlookers. These subjectivists, wrote Plekhanov, out to endow the individual with the greatest possible role in history, have refused to recognise mankind's historical development as a law-governed process. Plekhanov, who had been a Narodnik himself before helping form the Russian Marxist organisation, the Emancipation of Labour Group, in 1883, was highly regarded by Lenin and often referred to as the founder of Russian Marxism. Throughout the 1890s, the Emancipation of Labour Group built up a revolutionary following in Russia. When Lenin founded Iskra in 1900, Plekhanov wrote for the paper and together they launched powerful polemics against revisionists such as Bernstein. Bernstein believed that capitalist contradictions were getting weaker and that socialism, rather than being an imperative born out of the material conditions developing within capitalism, was merely an ethical goal. Attempting to transform Marxism into a theory of peaceful social reform, Bernstein criticised Marx's alleged economic determinism in much the same way that Marxism is attacked today. In response to his critics, who attributed to him the idea that ideas passively reflect economic development, Plekhanov argued that ideas arise on the basis of social being. However, once they have arisen on the basis of social being, the forms of human consciousness become part of history. Historical science cannot limit itself only to society's economic anatomy. In other words, Plekhanov was applying dialectics to a materialist analysis of history. Whilst individuals' action or inaction can at a decisive moment have a profound change on the course of events, this influence cannot be reduced to charisma or some other individual quality. It must involve the existence of social conditions which make their intervention at a certain juncture in history capable of influencing other events. Certain things, like cyclical crises and recessions, are features of capitalist social relations and that no individual can alter. As Plekhanov explains, it follows then that by virtue of particular traits of their character, individuals can influence the fate of society. Sometimes this influence is very considerable, but the possibility of exercising this influence and its extent are determined by the forms of organisation of society, by the relation of forces within it. The character of an individual is a factor in social development only where and to the extent that social relations permit it to be such. No matter what the qualities of the given individual may be, argues Plekhanov, they cannot eliminate the given economic relations if the latter conform to the given state of productive forces. So, for example, no matter how charismatic I am or how much influence I wield, I'll never be able to turn the clock back and convert the state of Victoria into a British colony. Nor could a leader of any of the First Nations of this country prior to British colonisation have built a movement to establish a socialist federation of Aboriginal nations throughout the continent because the material conditions did not yet exist to make such a project possible. This point also holds true in relation to the balance of class forces in society. In the absence of a strong trade union movement, to which large numbers of workers have the in which large numbers of workers have the experience, confidence and know-how to conduct effective mass strike action, my insistent urgings that the recent march in March be followed by a general strike to bring down the Abbott government fall on deaf ears. Whilst the individual in history can be seen to have played essential roles, such roles could only be undertaken in the given social conditions. Such was the case with the French Revolution of 1789, explained Carnot. It is the relation of social forces which, in the last analysis, explains the fact that Louis XV's character and the caprices of his favourite mistress could have such a deplorable influence on the fate of France, explained Carnot. Had it not been the king who had a weakness for the fair sex, but the king's cook or groom, it would not have had any historical significance, explained Plekhanov. Clearly, it is not the weakness that is important here, but the social position of the person afflicted with it. In other words, what Plekhanov was arguing was that the causes of the French Revolution lay in the nature of social relations. The personal qualities of the leading individuals play their part, but only within the general context and are subordinate to the broader historical forces at play. It follows then, explained Plekhanov, that individuals can influence the fate of society by virtue of definite traits of their nature. Their influence is sometimes very considerable, but the possibility of it being exercised and its extent are determined by society's organisation and the alignment of its forces. An individual's character is a factor in social development only where, when, and to the extent that social relations permit it to be. There are, therefore, definite limits to the role of individuals. Plekhanov explained, no great man can impose on society relations which no longer conform to the state of these forces or do not yet conform to them. In this sense, indeed, he cannot make history, and in this sense he would be trying in vain to shift the hands of his clock. He would not be accelerating the passage of time or turning it back. Plekhanov wrote that in discussing the role great men play in history, we nearly always fall victim to a sort of optical illusion. For example, in coming out in the role of the good sword to save public order, Napoleon prevented all the other generals from playing this role, and some of them might have performed it in the same way or almost the same way as he did. In other words, the personal power of a so-called great man, such as Napoleon, presents itself to us in an extremely magnified form, for we place to his account the social power which had brought him to the front and supported him. When we are asked what would have happened if there had been no Napoleon, our imagination substitutes a vacuum in its place. It seems to us that without him in the social movement upon which his power and influence were based, could not have taken place without him. Well, what about Lenin's decisive role in the Socialist Revolution of 1917 in Russia? Could another Bolshevik leader, even Leon Trotsky, have substituted Lenin's role? And if not, does this not contradict Plekhanov's thesis? Trotsky believed not. In his 1935 diary, Trotsky made the following observation about Lenin's role in the 1917 revolution. Had I not been present in 1917 in Petersburg, the October Revolution would still have taken place on the condition that Lenin was present and in command. If neither Lenin nor I had been present in Petersburg, there would have been no October Revolution, wrote Trotsky. If we admit that individuals can play a key role in catalysing certain events, doesn't it also follow that their absence might have the opposite effect? Do Trotsky's views contradict Plekhanov's, who argues in his essay that historical conditions give rise to a situation such that if one great man dies, another fills his place? Isn't Trotsky adhering here to the great man theory of history? Well, Deutsche actually argues this, argues that Trotsky, there's a lapse in Trotsky's dialectical method in his third volume of his biography of Trotsky, titled the, The Prophets Disarmed. Trotsky made a strong argument that the absence of Lenin could have had a profoundly negative effect on the Russian Revolution. Indeed, it might have been delayed or even have failed to materialise. In a revolutionary situation, timing is essential, and it is easy to let the moment pass when the optimal conditions for success exist. Before Lenin's arrival in Russia in April 1917, the Bolshevik Party was disoriented and unable to effectively lead. It is possible that without Lenin, the party could have been able to reorient itself, but it is also possible that it would not have been done in time and the revolutionary moment might have slipped. The same can be said for what might have happened on the eve of the insurrection in October 1917. If Lenin's role was irreplaceable, does this contradict Plekhanov's attitude to the role of the individual in history? Well, Lenin was a factor in Russian history only insofar as he was the foremost representative of the interests of a social force, that is, the proletariat, created by a set of social relations Lenin himself did not create, that is, combined and uneven development of capitalism in Russia, the rapid growth of a working class easily driven from economic to political struggle, a cowardly bourgeoisie, and a decrepit but repressive czarist autocracy. Lenin also could not have played the role he did had he not, with others, built a workers' party with deep roots in the most militant sections of the working class. Lenin was able, through the Bolshevik Party, to influence events only because he had an instrument consistent with the general trend of Russian history. As Trotsky explained, from the extraordinary significance which Lenin's arrival received, it should only be inferred that leaders are not accidentally created, that they are gradually chosen out and trained up in the course of decades, that they cannot be capriciously replaced, that their mechanical exclusion from the struggle gives the party a living wound and in many cases may paralyse it for a long period. And I think it's useful, that comes from Trotsky's History of the Russian Revolution, and I think I'd recommend that as a read to anyone as an excellent example of using a dialectical historical materialist method to understand the great events of the Russian Revolution. To quote again from Plekhanov, "The more or less slow changes in economic conditions periodically confront society with the possibility of more or less rapidly changing its institutions. This change never takes place by itself. It always needs the intervention of men or women, who are thus confronted with great social problems. And it is those men who do more than others to facilitate the solutions of these problems who are called great men." And that's Plekhanov's words. Lenin was in this sense a great man, but he could not, through his own efforts, prevent the revolution's slide into bureaucratic degeneration, because material conditions in Russia, the breakdown of industry, famine, the disintegration of the working class, and the retreat of the revolutionary wave across Europe would not permit a rapid advance towards a new socialist society. Well, Helvetius once said that every epoch calls forth persons of adequate stature, and if it cannot find them, invents them. In regard to Wellington, Engels remarked, "He is great in his own way, as great as one can be without ceasing to be a mediocrity." Well, such a description could easily be applied to Stalin, Lenin's successor in Russia, whose personality certainly left its stamp on the character of the political counter-revolution in the Soviet Union. While Trotsky represented the period of revolutionary upsurge, Stalin represented the period of retreat and counter-revolution. He became the figurehead of the bureaucratic reaction within the Soviet Union, as Trotsky described Stalin. And yet, all in all, he remains mediocre. He is capable neither of generalisation nor of foresight. His intelligence lacks spirit and buoyancy and is unsuited to thinking logically. Each sentence of his speeches serves a practical end. Never does a speech rise to the height of a logical construction. This weakness makes for his strength. There are historical tasks which can be carried out only if one renounces generalisations. There are periods when generalisations and foresight are a bar to immediate success. Such are the periods of decline and fall and reaction. Towards the end of his life, in January 1894, Friedrich Engels provided us with a summary of historical materialism, within which he dealt with the individual in history. Men make their history themselves, but not as yet with a collective will according to a collective plan or even a definite, delimited, given society. Their aspirations clash, and for that very reason, all such societies are governed by necessity, the complement and form of appearance of which is accident. The necessity which here asserts itself athwart all accident is again ultimately economic necessity. This is where the so-called great men come in for treatment. That such and such a man, and precisely that man, arises at a particular time in a particular country is, of course, pure chance. But cut him out, and there will be a demand for such a substitute. And this substitute will be found, good or bad, but in the long run will be found. While historical materialism gives primacy to the objective factors in history, such as the level of the productive forces and the existing class relations, the subjective factor can play an important role. The influence of an individual in the historical process can span from one of insignificance to being absolutely decisive. The degree of this influence will depend upon the stage of development of historical conditions, the correlation of social forces, and the role of the individual within these forces. As Lenin once observed, there are decades where nothing happens, and there are weeks where decades happen. Consequently, there are often long periods where even the most far-sighted revolutionary cannot have any effect on the course of history, whilst there are moments when, under critical conditions, an individual's role can be decisive.